It's tuned to yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's yesteryear. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. In this hour, mystery. Later on, we hear the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. But right now, it's suspense with the play A Vision of Death, starring Ronald Colman and Kathy Lewis. Her husband, Elliot, directs the broadcast, first heard on CBS on March 8, 1951.
Autolite and its 96,000 dealers present Suspense. Tonight, Autolite brings you a story of a mind reader who discovers his nightclub act is not a fake. A story we call A Vision of Death, starring Mr. Ronald Colman.
If I speak too rapidly for your stenographer, you'll tell me, won't you, Lieutenant? No offense, but he impresses me as someone who has to sit on the floor to put his shoes on. And don't hesitate to stop me if I seem to wander away from the point. I mean to say this is my first, and I hope, final appearance in a police precinct, and I should hate to give a sloppy performance. We were always known, Aurora and I, for the smoothness and gem-like precision of our act. And as for this murder, rap, I suppose it's called, is concerned, an acquaintance with our act is the essential rabbit. Awfully good act. Smart. Informal. Occasionally humorous and always mystifying. Well, the act always began with music. Never with the cliché fanfare of trumpets or roll of drums. I would saunter out to the center of the floor and say something like, "Good evening. You are about to witness an exhibition of mental telepathy. Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce Aurora, my wife." They never failed to give her a hand. What would they applaud? Why, the vision she presented as she came toward me. There has never been anyone as lovely as Aurora. The most beautiful flash in the profession. Aurora, would you care to tell the audience, or shall I?
You tell them, Judge, while I tie the blindfold across my eyes.
Ladies and gentlemen, all mind readers employ a gimmick. A gimmick is a trick, a device. For example, when the mind reader, threading his way through the audience, says to the mind reader sitting blindfolded on the stage, "A lady has given me a small object which I now hold in my hand. What is it?" And the mind reader sitting blindfolded replies, "A silver coin." The answer has not come through mind reading. No, it has come through the gimmick. A cue or signal communicated through the very question itself.
But we don't do that.
We do not. You will notice, ladies and gentlemen, that I never speak to Aurora at all. Are you ready, Rory?
Ready, Judd.
Here we go, then. You, sir. You have something? Go on. Concentrate upon it, like a good chap.
The gentleman holds a
and
coin
you, madam?
In his hand. It is a Mexican peso bearing the date 1892.
That's very clever of you, madam. I'll be surprised if she gets this one.
The lady holds in her hand...
How about you, young man?
...her other hand.
A sucker once born remains a sucker till death. The audience never realized, never in all the years we worked, that although I was not speaking to Aurora directly, my chatter nevertheless was loaded with signals and cues for her guidance. By revealing the gimmick, we concealed the gimmick, and that, Lieutenant, is the ne plus ultra of gimmicks. Yes, it was as crude as that, but it enabled us to work 50 weeks a year, here and abroad, at an average of over 1,000 a week. Of course, I always gave some credit for our success to our agent, Harry Arnold, although Rory was inclined to give him no credit at all.
Good news, Judd. I've managed to book the act into the College Inn in Chicago with a 4-week guarantee. Not bad, huh?
Get him. He managed to book the act.
Yeah.
I suppose they never heard of us in Chicago. I suppose we weren't held over there 6 weeks when we played the Sanssouci in 1948.
You think it's easy to get a 4-week guarantee these days? Money is short. Money is tight.
I've never yet heard you say money is long. Money is loose. You have to sweat for your 10%, don't you? Yes, you do. In a pig's ear, you do. Agents. They're all like...
Oh, there's gratitude for you. There's the milk of human memory. What were you when I first saw you? Nothing. Not this much. Playing 10 a day under canvas in Menasha, Wisconsin, and paid off in bottle tops. I worked, I schemed, I sweated.
Listen to him. You'd think he had to get out there on the floor every night. You'd think he was the one spent 11 months, 12 hours a day memorizing the code. You'd think it was his name in lights. Agents. All they know is how to live off a dead whale. Scum of the earth.
Look, I'm not going to take that from you, you hear me?
You'll take it, baby, along with the 10%. You'll take it and you'll chew it and you'll swallow it and you'll keep it down, too. How do you like that?
I'm warning you, kid. Don't push me too far.
Now,
don't push
children,
me too
children, on your way, Harry, and don't let it get you down. I think a four-week guarantee is pretty good.
Oh, thanks, Judd. If it wasn't for you, Judd, I'd... Oh, why go into it? I'm going for a walk.
But aside from these altercations between Rory and Harry, it was smooth sailing. We wore the best, ate the best, drank the best, stayed at the finest hotels. And every Saturday night after the performance, Harry would bring us our salary. He'd bring it in cash. $1,000, $1,250, $1,500. I have the old performer's distrust of checks. Been given too many with a high latex content. Anyway, life couldn't have been more placid. And then one evening, about 5 weeks ago, soon after we opened at the Grove here in town, a frightening thing occurred. We'd just begun the act, and I was out in the audience. You will notice, ladies and gentlemen, that I never speak to Aurora at all. Are you ready, Rory?
Ready, Judd.
There we go, then. Now, you, madam.
The lady holds in her hand a compact. It is platinum and bears her initials R.C.
You, sir.
The gentleman is holding an engagement ring. In it are three small diamonds.
The young lady
is holding... It's a small cameo brooch, and...
Rory! Quick, Maurice, music! I picked Rory up from the floor and hurried with her to our dressing room, almost beside myself with anxiety. I placed her on the couch, dampened a towel and put it on her forehead and began to chafe her wrists. Rory, honey.
Judd, what happened? I was in the bar. Do you want me to get a doctor?
No. I don't know. Get out. Leave us alone. Get out, Harry. Get out.
Judd.
I'm here, Rory. Are you all right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know what happened.
Oh, you fainted away. Try to remember what happened.
Oh, I felt funny. I don't remember.
No, try, Rory. Try to remember. It's important.
Oh, I can't. Why is it important?
Oh, you don't know? Rory, you don't know? You were calling out the answers before I even had a chance to give you the cue. Do you believe in telepathy, Lieutenant? Well, I don't mean the sort of thing Rory and I usually did. I mean real telepathy. I never did either until that night. I don't mind telling you I was badly shaken. I mean, after all, I knew we'd been using a gimmick, and suddenly it began to happen without the gimmick. It scared us to death. We didn't know what we were getting into. But we went on with the act, and in my mind, I began to search about for the answer. I found it, of course. You'll find a gimmick in almost everything if you look hard enough. I've got it, Rory. We've worked together so long that you know what I'm going to say before I say it. From my inflection, my pauses, even my movements. You see?
Judd, that has to be it.
Oh, this is marvelous. When Harry gets back, I'll tell him about it.
And if I last until tomorrow, he can ask the management for more dough.
Yeah, as soon as he gets back. Next Thursday.
Tonight. How much more should we ask for?
Well, we... Tonight? What made you say tonight?
I don't know, Judd.
Well, you were there when he told me he'd be in Palm Springs till Thursday. What made you say tonight?
I don't know. What difference does it make? Stop picking on me. So I made a mistake. So what?
Well, I don't see how you could make such a mistake, that's all.
Judd, leave me alone. I've been worried half crazy about really being able to read your mind. I've been under a strain. So Harry's coming back Thursday and not tonight. All right. You satisfied? He'll be here Thursday and not tonight.
You Judson Stone, mister? This dressing room, eh?
What is it?
A telegram. Sign here.
Oh, sign for it, will you, Rory?
There you are, kid. I'm sorry I blew up in your face, Judd. Judd, what's the matter?
It's from Harry. He's coming in tonight. And he did, too, Lieutenant. Rory was so upset by it, she couldn't go on at all that evening. She had no explanation for how she knew, none whatsoever.
I don't know, Judd. I just don't know. My mind seems to go blank, and I seem to hear a voice whisper in my ear, and Harry Arnold will be with you tonight, that's all.
When we got to our suite at the hotel, Harry was there waiting for us.
What happened? What happened? You both look like ghosts.
Oh, Harry, I'll tell you some other time. Leave us alone, will you?
All right, I'm going. Just came back to wish you a happy birthday and to give you this.
Birthday? Oh, yeah, thanks. Thanks, Harry, thanks. What is it?
Well, open it, why don't you?
It's a bathrobe. A red silk bathrobe with your initials.
That's right, it's a... How does she know? How do you know?
Get out of here. Get out of here! John, make him get out of
Look,
here!
I won't be talked to like that. I don't care who she is. I won't be talked
Harry,
to like
shut
that.
Up! For heaven's sake, shut up and go away. What? Leave us alone.
What?
Go, get out, get out!
You too, Judd? She's got you talking against me too, huh? All right, I'm going. I'm going. But from here on in, it's strictly business between us. I wash my hands.
He kept his word, Lieutenant. From that time on, he kept himself to himself. And I was prepared to let it go at that, much as I liked Harry. Until the night I was awakened by Rory, moaning in her sleep.
No, please. Oh,
Rory,
no.
Rory, wake up. No. You're having a bad dream. Rory.
No. What? Judd?
Shh. Quiet, easy. It's all right. I'm here.
Oh, Judd.
What, Rory?
The voice.
Whispering again?
Yes. Oh, Judd.
What?
He's going to kill me. Harry Arnold is going to kill me.
And that, Lieutenant, was the beginning of the end of that. Rory, get a grip on yourself.
He's going to kill me. Harry is going to kill me.
No, don't be ridiculous. Stop it now. It was just a bad dream.
Harry is going to kill me.
Will you stop that? Will you stop saying
Judd,
that?
Hold me. I'm frightened. Harry is going to kill me.
Now, you've had a bad dream, I tell you.
He hates me. He hates me, Judd. Judd, Harry is going to kill me.
I'm a rational man, Lieutenant. I've always felt, for example, that when Hamlet says there are stranger things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio, Horatio ought to reply, tell that to Sweeney. I knew there was no such thing as mental telepathy. I knew it as well as I know I'm sitting here talking to you. Up here in my head, I knew it. And yet, the next afternoon, I found myself entering a gun shop and purchasing a revolver and a box of bullets, determined that before Harry Arnold could so much as injure one hair of Rory's head, I would kill him. I should have gone directly to the police first. You're using hindsight, Lieutenant. I had all that out with Rory.
Please, Judd, please. Go to the police and tell them about this. Let them handle it.
Well, tell them what? That by reading his mind, we've learned Harry intends to murder you?
They'll believe us. They've got to believe us.
Oh, now, you're reasoning like a child. They'll decide that it's either a publicity stunt or else that we're both lunatics.
Well, if I tell them about the telegram and the birthday present...
Rory, we have no proof.
But we have to do something.
What? Tell me what? You know he intends to kill you. I know he intends to kill you, but what can we do? I can't simply put a bullet in his heart next time I see him. How could I explain it? My wife had a premonition that he was going to murder her. But do you know when he's going to do it? Or how he's going to do it?
No. He hasn't decided yet. Isn't there anything we can do?
Nothing. Except wait. I reacted to the waiting as you might expect, Lieutenant. Sleeplessness, loss of appetite, growing irritability. I flared up at everyone. Waiters, chambermaids, elevator boys, the manager of the club. The manager of the club, yes. He finally said to me...
Stone, what the devil's gotten into you? I'd really like to know.
None of your business.
Well, I'm only trying to be nice.
Oh, shut up and let me alone.
Yeah, sure, I'll let you alone. I'd let you alone right now if your contract didn't have another week to run. But after that, I'll let you strictly alone. You'll never work this club again. Maniac.
I began to drink quite heavily. Quite noticeably. I was going crazy just from the waiting. And then the waiting came to an end. It was around 3 a.m. I was sitting up in bed, in the dark, smoking, when Rory opened her eyes and said...
Judd?
Yes?
The voice.
Yes?
He's going to kill me. Here. Right here, in this room.
Rory.
Saturday. This Saturday at midnight. Judd.
Oh, Rory, sweetheart.
He's going to shoot me. He has a gun. And he's going to shoot me. He's going to get you downstairs in the manager's office at the club. And while you're there, he's going to come up here.
Rory, listen to me. I want you to listen to me. You're mistaken, do you understand? You've been having another bad dream, and that's all there is to it.
Oh, no, Judd, I swear it. He just thought of it. Just this minute. He's standing at a bar, standing there all by himself, drinking. And he just this minute decided.
Oh, you're making it up.
Judd, no. It's the bar over at the Tuscany Hotel. I see it so clear.
Well, you're wrong. I'll prove you're wrong.
Dad.
Give me the bar at the Tuscany, will you? Over on Sunset.
One moment, please.
Now, you'll see, Rory, he's not there at all. You'll see, it's just a dream. Just a bad dream.
Tuscany Cocktail Lounge.
Hello, is Harry Arnold there at the bar?
Harry Arnold? No, I'm sorry, he's not.
He's not, huh? You sure of that?
Well, sure, I'm sure. He was here all evening. Left about a minute ago. I said goodnight to him myself. You want me to call?
It wasn't a dream.
John?
No, Rory, don't worry. Trust me. When Harry comes tomorrow night, you won't be here at all. But I will. Look, Lieutenant, my hands, see? Just the memory of how I felt at that moment and my hands begin to tremble again. Amazing, isn't it? Well, that was last Thursday night, or rather Friday morning, and towards daybreak, Rory sobbed herself to sleep. But I was restless. I got dressed and went downstairs and got into my car. A long drive has always relaxed me, but when I got behind the wheel, I don't know what it was, possibly the fresh air, but all at once I felt as though I couldn't keep my eyes open for another moment. I simply had to have sleep. So I crawled into the back seat, curled myself up in one corner, pulled the rug over me, and went out like a light.
Hello, Satin Skin.
Hello, Harry.
I was awakened
don't
around noon
me,
by the sound
idiot.
Of voices.
He may see us. Look businesslike.
Where is he?
I don't know. Since he hasn't got the car, he must be out walking. Don't you have some papers or something I could be examining just to make it look good in
a
case...
A pocket full here.
All right.
Did he fall for it last night?
Just like he fell for all the rest of us. Red bathrobe, the plants in the audience. He even phoned the bar just after you left. I timed it beautifully.
Oh, Satin Skin. I can hardly keep away from you.
After tomorrow night, we'll have all the time in the world for each other, Harry.
You bought the whole story, huh? Midnight tomorrow, your place?
Every word of it. Just do what you have to do. Remember to come to the dressing room before the 8 o'clock show and tell him you've set up a meeting with Stamper, the manager, in his office at 12.
I want them to shake hands and be friends again, I'll tell him.
And don't forget, when you come to the door at midnight, keep talking to the elevator boy. Don't let him go, whatever you do. You'll want him to testify it was self-defense.
Don't worry, I won't forget a thing.
You'll handle all the rest of it?
Yeah, just leave it to me.
No, I mean about his gun. That's pretty important, you know.
Don't worry. It will misfire.
It'd be difficult for me to tell you what I felt as they walked away, Lieutenant. One part of me felt the way a man ought to feel, I suppose, when he learns that the woman he loves is not only unfaithful, but plotting his death as well. But another part of me felt only relief. Relief at learning there was a gimmick in this, too. Yeah, they'd been fairly clever for amateurs. Harry had a good excuse for carrying a gun to protect the cash he brought me each Saturday. My own behavior in recent weeks would lend weight to what he would probably offer in his defense, that I must have been crazy. But for no reason at all, I'd pointed a revolver at him and threatened his life, that he had to shoot in self-defense. The presence of the elevator boy, that could mean only that Harry would shoot just as soon as I opened the door. I'd be found dead with a revolver in my hand and a heartbroken agent at my side. Tableau. Then I found myself hoping, as I never hoped before, that they'd come to their senses before Saturday, that they'd realize what a vicious, inhuman thing it was they were planning. But just before the 8 o'clock show that night, there was a knock at the door of our dressing room. Come in.
Judd, I've been talking to Stamper, the manager. He's sorry this bad blood between you wants to square it. I told him you'd be in his office at 12 to talk things over. All right with you?
Yeah.
We don't want it so that we never work here again, do we? I mean, there's no reason we should.
No reason at all.
Button my dress, Judd.
See you later, Judd.
Yeah, later. Did the show and then went up to our suite. I helped Rory pack a small overnight bag. I loaded the revolver and then there was nothing to do but wait. The minutes passed. 9 o'clock, 10, 10:30, and I waited.
Judd.
Yes?
I don't want you to go.
It's best that you do.
It doesn't seem right to leave you here alone.
Things might not go as I planned. I might not be able to stop him. And if I fail to stop him... No, it's best that you go. Just wait at the motel until you hear from me. What time is it?
Almost 11. 2 minutes of 11.
I'm out of cigarettes.
Desk?
This is Mr. Stone in 1101. Please send up a carton of players, will you?
Right away, Mr. Stone.
I want you to go now, Rory.
Judd, let me call the police, please.
It would be useless. We've gone into it, and it'll be useless.
Then come with me. He won't find anybody here.
Well, then he'd choose another place, another time. Here's your valise.
You have your gun?
In my pocket.
You won't take any chances. I don't know what I'd do if you were hurt or anything.
I won't take any chances. Let me help you on with your coat.
Oh, Judd, I love you so.
Yes, I know. And I love you, Rory. I really do, you know. Ready?
Yes. 11 o'clock. He'll be here in an hour.
Go now, Rory. Kiss me goodbye.
Judd.
The cigarettes. Get them, will you, darling, while I find change? I shall always remember the look on Harry's face, Lieutenant, as she sank to the floor. They'd concocted a bad dream between them, and it had come true. I'll bet he still doesn't know how it happened, and if you pass his cell, Lieutenant, you might tell him. Whisper the word gimmick into his ear. That's what I said, gimmick. I gimmicked the clock while Rory was dressing. Set it back a full hour. It was 11 to her, but 12 to him. I adore gimmicks. Don't you? Thank you.
Suspense. Presented by Autolite. Tonight's star, Mr. Ronald Coleman.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Suspense, untuned to yesterday from March 8, 1951 on CBS. A radio show penned by a radio actor, Jerry Hausner. His only contribution to the radio medium in terms of writing. Other than that, he played parts on the Jack Benny program, The Cavalcade of America, Favorite Story, The Mel Blanc Show, and the Lux Radio Theater. It's an hour of mystery. On Tuned to Yesterday, I'm your host, Mark Levinier. And now Sherlock Holmes is on the air. From January 2nd, 1955, an NBC broadcast featuring Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson in the episode called Dr. Watson Meets Sherlock Holmes.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The original and immortal stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized anew, with Sir Ralph Richardson as Dr. Watson and Sir John Gielgud in the role of Sherlock Holmes.
John H. Watson. It may be familiar to you through my association over many years with one of the most remarkable men I believe the world has ever known, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. I want to tell you about one of our earliest adventures, the first time that we went out into the streets of London in active partnership. We were still youngish men. It was far back in the early 1880s, we had shared those famous rooms, number 221B Baker Street, for only a few months.
Watson, my dear fellow, you're just in time.
In time for what, Holmes?
Well, you've so often been good enough to express a genial interest in my singular profession. Now you'll be able to see me actually at work.
Oh, well, I'm delighted, Holmes. It should be fascinating. Ah, but I must sit down by the fire. Deuce chilly out.
Oh, do, my dear fellow. Ah, wait till you meet Milverton.
Milverton? Who's Milverton?
Charles Augustus Milverton of Hampstead. In all probability, the most evil man in London.
Indeed? He sounds fascinating.
I invited him for 6:30, so he's almost due.
Oh, I shiver at the thought of him. But what's he do for a living, this strange caller of ours?
Blackmail, Watson.
Huh?
Yes, he looks like Mr. Pickwick. But heaven help the man, or worse still, the woman, who's indiscreet enough to get into his power.
And what have you to do with him?
Well, I've had the honor recently to be consulted by a particularly illustrious lady.
Who is she? Do I know her?
Well, I expect you know her name. Lady Eva Brackwell, the most beautiful debutante of last season.
But, of course, isn't she to be married in a fortnight to the Earl of Dovercourt?
Yes. It's all arranged. Unluckily for her, Milverton has managed to get hold of some imprudent letters, Watson, which she wrote some time ago to a penniless young fellow in the country. Only imprudent, mind you, but they'd be quite sufficient to break off the match.
And you're commissioned to meet him?
Yes, and make what terms I can. I think he's here, Watson. Will you let him in?
Mr. Holmes' rooms?
Will you come in, please? This is Mr. Holmes. I take it you are...
Charles Augustus Milverton. How are you, Mr. Holmes?
No, I prefer not to shake hands with you, Mr. Milverton.
Huh?
This is only a matter of business between us.
I see. And we can talk of it before this gentleman. It's rather a delicate affair.
Dr. Watson is my friend and partner, sir. He knows our business.
Really? Well, we need hardly waste much time on it. My position is quite definite. You are acting for the Lady Eva, I understand.
I have that honor. What are your terms, Mr. Milverton?
£7,000, Mr. Holmes.
And the alternative?
Oh, my dear sir, it is painful to discuss it. But if the money is not paid by the 14th, there will certainly be no marriage on the 18th.
And supposing I advise my client to tell her future husband all about these letters you hold?
You evidently do not know the Earl, Mr. Holmes, nor me. I am practiced at this game, sir. Look at this pocketbook. I have 8 or 10 similar cases all maturing in it. Is how I make my humble bread.
You scoundrel.
As you like, sir. But there are details here that would surprise you for all your so-called knowledge of affairs. You may remember the sudden end of the engagement between the Honorable Miss Miles and Colonel Dorking. And only because the absurd sum of £1,200 could not be found in time.
7,000 is ridiculous, Milverton. Out of the question.
Is it? I think not. There was also the case of... no more names, perhaps. Well, sir? Watson, get behind him. Don't let him get out now. Now, sir, that notebook, if you please. You fool, Holmes. Stand back. Do you think I'd go about a business like mine unarmed? Stand back, I say. You too, Dr. Watson, or whatever your name is. Put up your hands.
Holmes, I'll... Keep still, Watson.
I expected something much more original, Mr. Holmes. I really did, from you. Do you think I'm such a fool as to carry the letters about with me? You only make me more determined than ever. One more word and I'll make it 8,000. And the 13th instead of the 14th. Good night, Mr. Holmes.
Was hardly prepared a few nights later, and on a particularly stormy evening, for the appearance in our chambers of a tall, rakish-looking young workman with a goatee beard.
Oh, good evening, Governor. How are you?
How am I? Now, look here, my good man. What do you think you're doing walking in here? These are private apartments.
I happen to live here, Watson.
Holmes.
Yes, I think I forgot to warn you about my little penchant for disguises, Watson. Just one among my many other accomplishments. Phew, what an appalling night outside. It's coming down in sheets.
But what on earth have you been doing?
Getting myself engaged to be married.
To be married? My dear fellow, I congratulate you.
Yes, to the housemaid at Charles Augustus Milverton's.
What?
I had to, Watson. I wanted information.
Oh, sure, that was going too far.
Not at all. In my present alias, I'm a rising young plumber named Estcott. I've walked and talked with that girl every evening for nearly a week. Such charming little talks they were, too. And now I know Milverton's house in Hampstead like the palm of my hand.
Yes.
From the basement to the attics.
Yes, yes, but Holmes, the poor girl, Holmes.
Well, it really can't be helped, Watson. She has to become a sacrifice on the altar of my art. Oh, fortunately, I find I have a hated rival in the shape of the local grocery assistant. He's sure to cut me out the moment my back's turned. Look out of the window, Watson. Ah, what a splendid night.
Well, you were only complaining about it a moment ago.
As an honest citizen, as a burglar, I approve of it.
As a burglar?
Yes, I propose to burgle Milverton's house before the night is over, Watson. It's the only way. I just want a few minutes to change my clothes and get rid of this ticklish beard, and then I shall be leaving you for the evening to your peaceful solitude.
No, no. Holmes, I'm coming with you.
My dear Watson.
You said that we were partners and that I should do something to shake off my indolence.
Well, we've been sharing these same rooms for some months now. It'd be amusing if we should finish up sharing the same cell. Do you really mean it, Watson?
To the death.
Well, you're a most delightful fellow. Do you think you could contrive to make us up a couple of masks?
Masks?
Mm.
Masks? In 5 minutes, from black silk. I've an old umbrella somewhere.
Excellent. Then that'll be your contribution. For my part, I shall be delighted to teach you how to use a jemmy and a glass cutter and this set of adaptable keys. Some wonderful specimens here. In 2 hours' time, Watson, we shall be in Milverton's study, where he keeps his safe. It adjoins his bedroom, unfortunately, but I think he's pretty sure to be sound asleep. My little fiancé tells me he always sleeps like a log. Is it a bargain, Watson?
It's a bargain, Holmes.
Well, here we are, you see. What did I tell you, Watson? Within 2 hours, we'd make a capital pair of burglars, you and I.
Like it, Holmes. It was too little trouble.
What do you mean, because the door of the study wasn't even locked? Oh, some oversight.
Look. There's a light under the bedroom door.
Yes. He often falls asleep with the bedroom lamp still burning. I learned that from my fiancée, too. Now then, Watson,
Stand over by the door there and give me a warning if we hear anyone coming.
Right.
If they come right in, we'll still have time to hide behind the window curtains.
Right.
I'll begin on the safe.
Right, right.
Now then, skeleton keys. Ah, so. This fellow's a fool, you know. He ought to have had a much more modern safe than this one. Now then, let's see. If I could only...
Now, it... Holmes, Holmes.
What is it, Watson? Confound it, I've almost got it open.
Someone coming, along the corridor. Two people.
Ah, oh, deuce, take it. What a moment to choose. It's too bad. Quick, then, behind the curtain. He can't have been in bed after all. Must have been waiting in the hall for someone.
Watson, are you all right?
Yes, I think so. Rather a tight fit.
Well, there's a gap here I can just see through. Someone's coming upstairs carrying an oil lamp. Ah, it's Milverton, all right.
There's a woman with him. Veiled.
Shh, they're coming in.
Well, miss, you decided to come then, half an hour late.
I couldn't manage any earlier. My mistress kept me.
Well, if she's a hard mistress, you have your chance to get even with her. You tell me in your note that you've managed to get hold of some letters which compromise the Countess d'Albert.
Yes, I have.
You want to sell them and I want to buy them. So far, so good. I can use them in my business. Now, as to price...
The price, Mr. Milverton, for everything, is your life.
What do you mean, girl?
Look at me.
She's lifting her veil, Holmes. That's no lady's maid.
Great heavens! Is it you?
Yes, it's I, Charles Milverton. And don't you dare to speak my name. You've fouled it enough. You've ruined me the way you've ruined so many others.
You should have found the money in time.
And because I couldn't. Because I begged you for 2 days' grace. You sent those letters you had to my husband. And he died. And you know how he died. The finest man in the world. And the letters were false. You changed the dates on them. They were written before I met him.
Keep back from me. Put that pistol down!
No, not till I've used it. You'll break no more hearts, Charles Milverton, as you've broken mine. You hound. Oh. You filthy hound!
Oh. Great heavens, Holmes!
Quiet, man. He's done for. And she's got away, thank heaven.
Who was that woman, Holmes?
Surely you know that face, Watson.
Not... But Duchess...
I'll never mention names, Watson. Now's our chance if we're quick.
What are you doing, ma'am?
Safe, Watson. The papers in the safe. To save our own client and who knows how many more besides. Quick, put that bundle in your pocket, Watson.
Yes, yes.
And give the rest to me. Hurry. Yes. Someone must have heard the shots. Listen. There are people coming. Out of the window quickly, Watson.
So we escaped. Down a convenient drain pipe, over two garden walls, and luckily found an empty hansom at the bottom of the road, and reached Baker Street at last, and safety. Our adventure was over, or almost over. As I lay tossing sleeplessly in bed that night, I found myself more than ever intrigued by the personality of my strange companion. I recollected our first meeting only a few months before. I'd just come back from medical service abroad and was moping miserably about this old London of ours, of hansom cabs and fog and gaslight, doing simply nothing at all. And then, standing at a Piccadilly bar one day...
Hello there, Watson. Remember me?
Why, yes. Stamford, young Stamford.
He used to be a dresser under you, and you were a medical student at Bart's, remember?
Of course I remember. Confound it, it's a pleasure to see a friendly face, Stamford. London's the very deuce for a lonely man.
Oh, what on earth have you been doing with yourself, Watson? You're as thin as a lark and brown as a nut.
Oh, Afghanistan, you know. Uh-huh. The campaign out there, army surgeon. I say, have a drink, will you?
Thanks, don't mind. Start, I think.
I got wounded pretty badly. At my wand, confounded nuisance, subclavian artery. Two glasses of stout, please.
Invalid it out, then, eh? And what are you doing with yourself now?
Nothing. Trying to solve the problem of finding comfortable rooms on an army pension, 11 and 6 a day, eh? Well, here's your health, Stamford.
Yours, Watson. Here's to old times. Strange you should say that, you know.
Say what?
About looking for rooms. You're the second man today who said that to me.
And who was the first?
Oh, some fellow was working in the chemical lab up at the hospital. A fellow called Holmes.
You wouldn't like to go halves, I suppose?
Exactly what he was saying. Looking for someone to share with him, you know.
I'm the very man, then. What's his other name?
Sherringford, is it? No. Sherlock. Knew it was something queer. Sherlock Holmes.
What's he do?
Oh, deuced if I know. He's got a whole store of out-of-the-way knowledge that would astonish the professors. And he's a first-class chemist. Says he's going in for something quite special. I say, Watson.
Huh?
Let's go along to the lab and meet him. He's bound to be there. Let's have lunch somewhere and then go on, shall we?
Excellent. I only hope it comes to something. I must confess, he sounds quite interesting.
Watson, this is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
How are you, Doctor? From Afghanistan, I perceive.
What? How on earth did you know that?
Never mind.
Holmes, I wanted you two to meet because Watson's on the lookout for someone to share diggings with him.
Oh.
The same as you are.
Capital, Doctor. You look the very man for me. I've had my eye on a suite in Baker Street. Number 221B. Mrs. Hudson is the landlady's name. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope.
I always smoke ships myself.
That's good enough, then. Oh, and I generally have a few chemicals about and carry out experiments like this one. That wouldn't annoy you.
By no means.
Well, then let me see. What are my other shortcomings? Oh, I get down in the dumps sometimes and don't open my mouth for days on end. And, I have a fancy for revolver practice indoors.
So long as I can rely on your aim.
Infallible, I assure you. Now, what have you to confess?
Oh, well, I get up at all sorts of ungodly hours, and I'm very lazy. I don't like too much row, but I put up with revolver shots.
Good.
I've got another set of vices when I'm well, but these are the principal ones for the present.
Then that's all right. Thank you, Stamford. I'm very much obliged to you. Well, shall we go together, Dr. Watson, and look at the rooms tomorrow? Say at noon?
At noon, Holmes. It'll suit admirably.
Oh, one other little thing, the violin. You don't include violin playing in your category of rows.
It depends on the player, my dear Holmes. If it's badly played...
Ah, that's something I shall have to leave you to judge for yourself, my dear fellow. And I shall have pleasure in testing your ear with a few of my own little compositions. Then you will be able to judge my modest capabilities. Till tomorrow, then, my dear Dr. Watson. Till tomorrow.
Took those rooms together and settled down quite amicably. As the weeks went by, my interest in my companion intensified. I studied his sharp, piercing eyes, his thin, hawk-like face, and I wondered time and again what he did for a living, so as to pay his share of our humble reckoning. He was out at all sorts of strange hours, and when he was at home, curious visitors were always calling on him. And then he would ask if he might have our sitting room to himself. It was a thin, sallow, dark-eyed fellow called Lestrade, for instance, who came three or four nights in one week. Once, a fashionably dressed young girl waited on him. At another time, it was a railway porter in his velveteen uniform. The thing puzzled me until, at last, one day...
Ah, you wonder what I do for a living, Watson, eh? I've seen you looking quizzically once or twice at these visiting clients of mine.
Clients, Holmes?
Yes. Oh, just pass me over the Persian slipper, will you, my dear fellow? I always keep the tobacco in it. Thank you. The fact is, I'm a professional thinker, Doctor.
A thinker?
Certainly. I piece things together, you see, just as a logician could infer the possibility of an Atlantic or a Niagara from a single drop of water without having seen or heard of either of them, so I build rare edifices of deduction from the observation of a few simple facts.
Oh, come home.
No, it's the truth, I assure you. If you're looking round for a cigar, by the way, my deaf chap, you'll find them in the coal scuttle. Yes, I have a trade all my own, Watson, the only one in the whole world. I'm a consulting detective.
Oh, does London full of detectives, Holmes?
Oh, lots of government ones and plenty of private ones, but none like me. I've built up quite a special little connection, Watson. And when any of these other fellows are at a loss, they generally come to me to put them right.
Just by thinking about things, I suppose.
Exactly. I have a turn for observation and deduction. As you must have noticed. That first time we met, for instance, when I mentioned to your surprise that you'd just come from Afghanistan...
Oh, you had told about it, no doubt.
Nothing of the sort, Watson. I just knew. It's second nature to me. My train of thought ran something like this. Here's a fellow who's a doctor, but with the air of a military man, clearly an army surgeon, then. Just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, but that isn't his natural color, for his wrists are fair. His arm is stiff, he's been wounded. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have been wounded lately? And the obvious answer was in the Afghan campaign, probably the Battle of Maiwand.
It's simple enough when you explain it. I confess I was taken aback a bit at the time. And do you mean to say that you apply these principles to the detection of crime?
Of course I do. That fellow Lestrade you were asking me about the other day, for instance, he's a Scotland Yard man, one of the best. But he got himself into a fog over a forgery case recently and came to me to ask my advice on the evidence he had. I solved it for him on the spot.
Upon my life, you astonish me, Holmes. I'd no idea that that was what you were up to. What gave you the notion?
Oh, natural talent, I suppose. When I was still at college, a small thing happened to come my way which enabled me to solve a curious crime. I decided that I had a taste for such matters, and so here I am now, a professional investigator. That's the kind of thing I deal with in this life of mine, Watson. That, and of course my music.
Well, I never thought of you as a professional investigator of crime. Even when you talked about it so much at the hospital that time we met.
Well, one really must do something to keep oneself from boredom. You may find yourself mixed up in it one of these fine days, you know. You never know, Watson. You never know.
And I was, of course, you know that now, with the Milverton exploit, as I've related it, as the first real adventure of them all in which I felt myself truly involved. It ended rather oddly, that burglary episode of ours. The very morning after it, after my sleepless night, there came in the little man I'd so often seen before.
Lestrade, the good Lestrade of Scotland Yard. Good morning, my dear Lestrade.
Good morning, Mr. Holmes. I was wondering...
Oh, this is Dr. Watson, by the way. He was asking all about you the other day.
How do you do, Doctor? Any friend of Mr. Holmes is a friend of mine.
Delighted to meet you, Inspector. Well, sit down, won't you, and share a pipe with us.
Too much of a hurry, I'm afraid. I just wanted to ask if you had anything particular on hand, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, I don't think so. Nothing much. A little matter down at the docks involving a giant rat from Sumatra.
You can leave the rats to look after themselves, Mr. Holmes. There's been murder done up at Hampstead. Wanted you to look into it for us. Queer business.
Oh, really? Who's been murdered?
Fellow called Milverton.
Indeed. I believe I've heard the name.
Holmes. Holmes.
Not feeling dicky, are you, Watson? Any details, Lestrade?
Well, we know who did it, of course.
You know? Good heavens.
Couple of them, Doctor. Nearly got them, they did. There was a hue and cry, you see. They got away, worse luck, where they were seen.
How interesting. And what are they supposed to look like?
The first one, very tall. Other fellow, middle-sized, thick-necked man with a moustache.
Moustache,
they both had masks over their eyes.
Oh, come, Lestrade, that's rather vague, isn't it? On my soul, it might even be a description of Watson and me, eh, Watson?
It might indeed.
You're right, Mr. Holmes, you're perfectly right. By Jove, it might be. Well, will you handle it?
I'm afraid not, Lestrade, not this time. I know something of this fellow Milverton. He was a rogue and a blackmailer. There are certain crimes that the law can't punish adequately, my dear fellow. And in this instance, my sympathies are with the criminals, Lestrade. I will not handle the case.
Well, if you won't, you won't. I'll get the fellows all right in time, I dare say.
Will you, Lestrade? Oh, I do hope you may. Pass me my violin as you go out. There's a good fellow. I feel deuced lazy this morning. Had rather a strenuous night.
Pleasure, Mr. Holmes. Well, good morning, Doctor. See you again, I dare say.
Always in and out of Baker Street, you know.
Good morning, Inspector.
Morning, Mr. Holmes.
Good morning. Best of luck, Lestrade.
Oh.
What?
Another 5 minutes like that, Holmes. I'll take myself back to Afghanistan.
Oh, no, you won't, Watson. You'll grow to love it, too. This is only the beginning, my dear fellow. Only the beginning.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, based on the original stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, have been dramatized anew. Sir Ralph Richardson played the part of Dr. Watson, and Sir John Gielgud, that of Sherlock Holmes. The program was produced by Harry Allen Towers.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes on Tuned to Yesterday from January 2nd, 1955 on NBC. The story was based on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's work, The Adventures of Charles Augustus Milverton, which was first published as part of 13 short stories by Doyle, called The Return of Sherlock Holmes, released in 1904. And that brings to an end this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for listening.